Our reading is in Luke chapter 12, continuing our series in Luke's Gospel, and we're going to read together in verses 13 to 34. So just by way of introduction, on the first 12 verses or so, just a little recap. Jesus has been teaching his disciples what it means to live for him, to live for Jesus in a way that is unafraid and unashamed in a world that is very often hostile to that. And in the first 12 verses, he's really kind of put it into four categories, that it's easier, I'm able to live for Jesus in a way that is unafraid and unashamed. First of all, when my heart is free from hypocrisy. Certainly, when I remember or when I trust that he knows me perfectly, that he cares for me eternally. Thirdly, when I remember that if I confess Jesus, then he will confess me in the presence of the Father. And fourthly, it's easier to live for Jesus in a way that is unafraid and unashamed when I trust that I have the Spirit to help me in my witness. And that was the end of verse 12. The Spirit will teach you in the very hour what you ought to say. So chapter 12, verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" He said to them, "Take care, be on your guard against all covetousness. One's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And he told them a parable, saying, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I've nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you've ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you. The things you have prepared, whose will they be?' So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." He said to his disciples, "Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat, not about your body, what you will put on. For life is more than food, the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens. They neither sow nor reap. They've neither storehouse nor barn, and yet God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? Which of you, by being anxious, can add a single span or a single hour to his span of life? If then you're not able to do as small a thing as that, why are you anxious about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin, yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass, which is alive in the field today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? And do not seek what you are to eat, what you are to drink, nor be worried. For all the nations of the world seek after these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, seek his kingdom, and all these things will be added to you. Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give to the needy. Provide yourselves with money bags that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches, no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." Amen. I read a while ago, I couldn't actually tell you where I read it, about a man who died, and it was his wish. Sometimes you get these, it was his wish to be buried in his Rolls Royce. And they dug a huge hole, and presumably it was in some kind of shroud. I don't want to give you a gross picture, but it was a huge big hole, and they put the Rolls Royce in it with the guy sitting at the wheel, and somebody standing around the side looked in and went, "Wow, that's really living." And I said, "Of course it's not." You do get these odd requests sometimes. The weirdest one I remember getting in Glasgow was somebody who wanted cremated in a coffin full of Maltesers. But anyway, but the point of this one is that people look at it, and because that is, it's a picture of of wealth and somebody celebrating and saying, this is my most treasured thing. The most treasured thing I have is my car. And it doesn't have to be a Rolls Royce for that to be true. But it looks to the world's eyes as though he's made it. That's wealth. That's what the whole point of the thing is. That's why we're here, and he has made it. He's reached the pinnacle of what human life is all about. So the farmer that Jesus talks about in response to the question that is shouted from the crowd, or the invitation, something, is a man who has who is trying to make it and thinks he knows the way. And Jesus is trying to show his disciples, and he's trying to show the crowd, that their assumptions are topsy-turvy, that they've got the whole thing the wrong way around. Now, the question that initiates Jesus' teaching here is a question about inheritance. So the man in the crowd, and we can relate to the man in the crowd, right? That's why this is a lesson that is relevant to us, because we can relate to this man who says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." If we were in that situation and we felt that we were being defrauded, whether inheritance or some other mechanism, we would feel that there was some injustice that needed addressed there. And this person comes to Jesus because Jesus is the authority figure in the community, and he says to Jesus, "I'm not asking you to mediate here. What I'm asking you to do is to take my side. I'm asking you to argue my case for me, push my case and sort this out." And Jesus refuses to do that and exposes that what is in fact in the man's heart, this is not an issue about a need for justice. What is in his heart that is coming out masquerading as a desire for justice is covetousness, the sin of covetousness. And Jesus expands it because he doesn't just say, you know, you need to watch the covetousness that's in your heart. Jesus addresses everybody, take care and be on your guard against all forms of covetousness, or all covetousness. So they can't all stand there and look at him and go, "Did you see that man? How Jesus brought him down a peg or two? Wouldn't have liked to be him." Because we're all guilty of doing that kind of thing. Jesus turns his gaze upon everybody and gives them the warning. Now, the sin of covetousness is one that probably falls into the category of being much easier to see in other people than it is to see in ourselves. And that was Paul's experience. When Paul talks in Romans chapter 7, he says, and remember, Paul says in Philippians that in regard to the law, he was considered blameless, the law of the Old Testament. "If it had not been for the law, I would not have known sin. I would not have known what it is to covet if the law had not said, 'You shall not covet.' But sin, seizing an opportunity through the commandment, produced in me all kinds of covetousness." So the picture Paul gives of himself is this man who sticks so rigidly to the law that it's very difficult to identify any place that he has breached it. Until, this is in his own eyes, until for some reason something brings covetousness onto his radar. And it's like, you know, if you're going to buy a new car, or you're going to get a car and you've not got it yet, but you know it's going to be blue. When you drive around, you suddenly notice all the blue cars, right? So something has brought covetousness onto Paul's radar, and suddenly he looks at his life and it's everywhere. And that's what brings Paul to the point where he realized, I need forgiveness. I need salvation. Because he thought he was fine. He thought he was doing okay under his own righteousness, until covetousness rears its head in his life. So this man is in a similar way. What he needs is that same moment of realization. We all need that same moment of realization. Yes, it's inheritance. There's nothing wrong with inheritance. Jesus is never saying that there's anything wrong in possessions and having possessions. This is about priorities. And he's saying, what's in your heart is not a desire for justice. It is greed. And it's masquerading. The inheritance thing is masquerading what is really there. And Jesus is saying, I am here to take the mask off and to show you, when you look in the mirror, what your motive is, what your driver is, that you're really the kind of guy who once buried in his Rolls Royce. Now, the man didn't expect that. We don't expect that when we come to Jesus. We come to Jesus and we want Jesus to solve our problems. Jesus, argue my case. When we ask, what would Jesus do? What we usually mean is, if we ever use that in a discussion, I'm a nice guy. Jesus would likely agree with me. Jesus would argue my case. There's no way that Jesus would think something different. He wants Jesus to solve his problem. We don't often come to Jesus expecting him to challenge us and to change us and to say, that's not, your problem is not inheritance. Your deepest need is your heart and where your treasure is and what's important to you. And I'm here, says Jesus, to change you. So it prompts the parable that we commonly call the rich fool. And I have some solidarity with this man, I must confess, because I remember reading in a commentary once that nobody realizes he's a fool until he starts to talk. And I think probably that's, you know, there's, I have found sometimes when I stay silent that people assume because I'm a minister I have a certain level of wisdom, and that impression kind of evaporates as soon as I do try and talk into the situation. So this man, as soon as he starts to talk, we realize that he's got a whole load of false impressions. First of all, his first false impression is he doesn't understand the nature of blessing. Verses 17 and 18, what shall I do? I've nowhere to store my crops. I will do this. I'll tear down my barns. I'll build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and all my goods. So he thinks that blessing exists in God giving us more things and God giving us more material wealth. And again, we can probably all at various levels relate to that. We use the word blessing as the way the world uses lucky. And I know that I go on about this reasonably, well, occasionally, that something bad happens and then something that the world calls lucky intervenes and we go, it was a great blessing. You know, my car broke down and, well, lo and behold, the guy who was behind me was a mechanic on his day off and he stopped to fix my car at the side road. What a blessing. Everything worked out fine, which is great. But what do we say to people then who say, I've had a terminal diagnosis and there's no hope? Because if you say blessing is in these good things happening, then you're in a position where it becomes very difficult to say to these people, or people whose car breaks down and there's not a mechanic, and they can't afford to fix it, that God is somehow not blessing them. So his idea of blessing is wrong. It's nothing to do with God having a hold of you when you're going through whether good times or the bad times, which is what blessing actually is. It's knowledge that God is with you and that God will carry you and sustain you. For him, it's all about the fact that God is giving him more stuff, or he perceives that God is giving him more stuff. He's wrong, or has a false impression about blessing. He has a false impression about time and how much time he has. I will say to my soul, verse 19, you've ample goods laid up for many years. And God says, this is your last day. This is the last day of your life. And you're spending it collecting stuff for the future. The purpose of his life he misunderstands as well. Verse 19, so the second half of the same verse, laid up for many years, relax, eat, drink, and be merry. And he doesn't understand either who ultimately has control of his life. You have many years. No thought for his soul. No thought for his eternal relationship with God. And God says to him, whose will they be? James chapter 4, verse 15. You ought to say this. If the Lord wills, we will live and do this or do that. And Jesus says to him, or God says to him, fool. Fool. Not in the way that we hear people use the word, which means you're stupid, you're brainless, you're an idiot, or whatever, you know, the kind of insulting way. It means not so much that he's brainless, but that he is godless in his thinking. He started off by asking the right questions. What shall I do? I have nowhere to store my crops. But he came to the wrong answer because his heart and his treasures were in the wrong place. And the wrong answer that he came to was that I will invest in my own long-term security. And there's nothing wrong with investing in your future. I'm not saying, you know, stop paying your pension contributions and all that kind of stuff. But this is the most important thing to me. I will use what God has given me to look after number one. That is my God. My security, my future. We sang there, you give and you take away. My heart will choose to say, blessed be your name. Sometimes life can be really rubbish. I had a friend who told me once about singing that song, and he sang it a few months after his son had died, and I think a year or so after his wife had died, and they sang it, and they sang that verse over and over again. It's because it's such an important verse. They said it came home to me in a way that it never has before. You give and you take away. There's a gritty determination in what we sang there. When God takes away, my heart will choose to say, blessed be your name. You are good. And my security is not in the things that you gave, because they will fade and they will break. My security is, blessed be your name. Jesus then gives his disciples, after the parable, and it's important to notice that he says in verse 22, there's a bit of a switch. He's talking to everybody with the parable, but then in verse 22, he turns to his disciples, and Luke tells us he's talking to his disciples now, and he's giving them, if you like, a path to freedom, a way out of that rut that so many of us get into, that rut of covetousness and having our treasure in the wrong place. The meaning of what it is to be rich toward God. So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. End of verse 21. So turns to the disciples, therefore, this is what you need to know if you would have a life that is not treasures in the wrong place, but is rich toward God. And it means living a life of dependent trust upon the Father. Now, it's interesting to notice here that Jesus talks about there are two types of, I don't like using the word fool, right? It's not because it translates into our language as an insulting word, but that's not in the way that Jesus means it, but it is the word that we have to go with. There are two types of foolish worries about covetousness. The first one is the guy who's known as the parable of the rich fool. That's the person who wants to gather and his mind is preoccupied by the abundance of things. How am I going to store more? How am I going to acquire more? That's one kind of foolishness. But there's another kind of foolishness around covetousness. And that's the person who doesn't have an abundance. Their worry is not about how will I store this overwhelming abundance of goods, but their worry is one that we can much more understand. It's deficiency. Because when Jesus starts talking to the disciples, he tells them, don't worry about your life, what you will eat, your body, what you will put on. A poor man worrying over food and clothing can also fall into the trap of believing that life consists in possessions and in what you have. It's not saying don't seek food. The ravens have to seek the food. But that can still lead to a kind of covetousness. It is easy. As a minister, as a preacher, I can tell you, you will know this, it is easy to stand up in front of a group of people and attack the rich in the world, right? And tell them that they should all be selling up and doing more with their money and all the rest. But Jesus is saying it's not only there. Every form of covetousness, not just the obvious ones, not just the ones that are easy to attack, however much you have, examine your heart. What is important to you? What absorbs your thoughts? Jesus gives two, let's call them arguments, in support of his point. The first one is about how valued we are. Arguments to support his point that we should live a life dependent upon God and be free from this kind of covetousness. The first one is value, and he talks initially there about the ravens. Now, ravens were to the Israelites an unclean bird. They were off the menu. You never went into a cafe or a restaurant in ancient Israel and sat with a menu and went, I think I'll have the raven tonight. It wasn't there. It was an unclean word, an unclean Bird. It's only one letter away. Bird, word. Okay, anyway. It was more than one letter. Sorry, I'm feeling a stickler for detail. But it rhymes, word and bird. That's why my brain was in the wrong place, amongst other reasons. Off limits, it's not on the menu. And the ravens, of course, have to work for the food. But God says, Jesus says to them, when you see these birds, right, you see them at the side of the road, you see them picking carcasses of well, around here, there seems to be a lot of badgers killed on roads recently, but whatever it is, lots of dead animals at the side of the road. When you see the ravens eating at these things, remember that your Father is feeding them, that your Father is providing for them. He gives to the beast their food. He gives to the young ravens that cry. Psalm 147, verse 9, Job as well. Who provides for the raven its prey, for the young ones that cry to God for help and wander about for lack of food. When you see that, this is your challenge. You'll all have a favorite Christian worship song about faithfulness, right? Great is thy faithfulness, or faithful God, or whatever it might be. When the next time you see birds at the side of the road ripping meat off a dead, stinking carcass, sing that song in your head, because that's what you're seeing. Great is thy faithfulness. God is feeding the ravens, and he has told us when we see that, that's meant to be a sermon. He feeds the unclean birds. How can you believe that he might not feed you? This is the faithfulness of God. We also sang, when peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, it is well with my soul. I'm sure I've told you the story of that hymn before. The man sent his family across the Atlantic Ocean ahead of him. They were traveling across the Atlantic, his wife, and I believe it was either three or four daughters. The ship they were on sank. The daughters were all killed. The wife survived. She wrote a telegram to him. He got this message to say that all of his daughters had drowned. And he got on a ship, and he followed his wife. And the moment where that ship sailed over the spot where his daughters drowned in that sinking ship, he wrote that hymn. When sorrows like sea billows roll, it is well with my soul. The faithfulness of God, a sermon given when we see the ravens, or, says Jesus, the lilies. Do you ever wonder why God lavishes such extravagant splendor on something that is so fragile and so fleeting and so often unseen? How many flowers does God make that nobody ever sees? God is not a pragmatist. He's not an accountant who measures up the benefit of how many people will enjoy this, and based on that, the investment that he brings. How much beauty and extravagance does God pour out on a world, raining places where it doesn't benefit anybody? And Jesus says, these are all sermons, and the point of them all is the same. Great is thy faithfulness, the God who provides. And your problem, he says to the disciples, is that you don't consider it enough. You don't consider it rightly. You don't look and get the message of creation. And the last thing that Jesus says, the last kind of aspect or part of his argument here, is the extent to which living dependently upon God depends on or relies upon our increasing understanding of the relationship that we have. So we've got the value, you're more valuable than the birds, you're more valuable than the plants, and there is the relationship. The world, pagans chase after all these different things. The nations of the world seek after these things. Your Father knows that you need them. Instead, seek his kingdom, and all these things will be added to you. Fear not, little flock. It is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. It all rests on our trust of that relationship. We all have different types of relationship. You know, when you're in a marriage, you trust the person you're married to will be faithful to you. Sometimes, of course, in a worldly setting, that, you know, that breaks down because people are sinners. But when it comes to our relationship with our Father, that trust can be absolute, and it never needs waver. And all of our confidence, the only thing that will release us from covetousness, which is building our own treasures and putting our hearts there, is an understanding of the nature of that relationship. We can trust him. We can trust him. That on the last day, nobody will stand up on the day of judgment and say, I trusted him and he let me down. Won't happen. And that's for you. That's his relationship with you. You're above the ravens. You're above the lilies. But ponder them. Ponder unclean birds. Ponder fragile flowers. I came across a little proverb when I was preparing for this. It's a wee silly thing, but I thought it might be a good point at which to finish. Said the robin to the sparrow, I should really like to know why these human beings rush about and worry so. Said the sparrow to the robin, I think it must be that they have no heavenly Father such as cares for you and me. When we think about covetousness, it's not about having a go and saying to people, you're much too married to your material possessions. It's a lesson about saying, you've got a heavenly Father you can trust, and he'll never let you down. And back over to our praise band to lead us.